This is Digital Story Podcast number 1021, October 14th, 2025. Today's theme is 7 Techniques for Bending Reality in the Sierras. I'm Derek Story. Yes, we're back from the Eastern Sierra. One discussion topic that ran through the entire week was keeping it real or going surreal. Our photographers embraced a variety of approaches to create their own unique images. And I will share those with you on this week's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. The deep blue of high mountain lakes, the vibrant yellows and oranges of aspens and cottonwoods, the weathered wood of Bodie, and the surreal tufa at Mono Lake. You would think this would be enough to fill the eyes of any photographer. But many of us wanted to further transform these amazing scenes into our own works of art. We wanted to go beyond postcard and calendar shots in search of a look that was unique. And that's exactly what we did. So this week I have 7 techniques for you from the Eastern Sierra, compliments of our workshop crew. These were the things that they were working on and presented during our class presentation on the last day of the event. And I have to tell you, it was a stunning show. It was really terrific. So we were lucky, before I get to the 7 techniques, we were lucky to have both fantastic weather. As I speak right now, a storm has moved into the Eastern Sierra, and it is an entirely different place than the week that we spent there ending on Saturday. We hit the fall color in all of its glory, the cottonwoods, the aspens, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Sunny days, not too cool, not too warm. At night, it did get a little chilly in the mid-30s or so. During the day, we were up around 60 degrees. We usually did 2 photo shoots a day. We would go out in the morning. I would have a whole schedule lined up for the week, and we would hit one location in the morning and just be out, enjoy that beautiful morning light. Then we would come back to our wonderful workshop headquarters. We had a place to stay where everybody had their own room with a private bathroom, but yet we had a downstairs kitchen, we had an eating area, lab area, and then a sitting area for if you just wanted to relax and talk with other photographers. And we had the whole thing to ourselves. It was really beautiful. And it was a house that was built in the 1870s, so it had a lot of charm. The rooms were decorated in period, most of them. And so you would walk into one room and it'd be different than the previous room, but they all felt like they came from the same point in time. It was a great setting for the kind of work that we were doing. And we would just hang out there in the middle part of the day. We served both breakfast and lunch there, and then do a little bit of lab work. And then usually we were back out in the field in the afternoon for another photo shoot. We'd go out there, take our pictures, experiment, do all that good stuff, and then head back to headquarters and wrap it up for the evening. Now, that usually meant a little bit more lab work or sitting around and talking with other photographers. And because we were all in the same place, when you got tired, you just wander up and go to your room. And everyone else could stay downstairs and keep chatting. So that was the pace of the week. It was fantastic. And also, we were right in the middle of Bridgeport. So if you wanted to go out to eat or go get some groceries or something, all you had to do was walk out the front door, out onto the beautiful front porch, and just take a few paces up the street, and everything was right there. You never had to get in your car to have a meal or to get some supplies or just get some fresh air or take some cool neon shots at twilight. This crew, we're a creative bunch. We really are. And, you know, I always try to foster as much creativity as I can during the workshop, because I figure that is the time to be doing that kind of stuff. I mean, this is the one time when you don't have people rushing you. You know, when we go on trips with friends who aren't photographers, or we hang out with our families on family vacation, they are tolerant to a point of our indulgence, of our creativity, but then they want to get in the car and go to the next spot, right? And we're standing there going, oh, I just finally found the shot that I wanted, or just figured out the technique that I wanted to employ to really make this special. But yet it's time to get in the car. But when we're on a workshop, you have time. You have time to hang out. You can talk with other photographers. And during the week, when we have our lab sessions, which we do every day, you can see what other photographers are working on. You go, oh man, that's kind of cool. So then the next day, you can go out and try that technique for yourself. So you have not only the inspiration from nature every day, but you have the inspiration of your fellow artists every day. And the whole thing just kind of keeps rolling and rolling and rolling all the way up to the final class presentation, where everyone shows a few of the shots that they want to talk about. It's not a competition at all. It's a sharing session where you go, wow, this is something new I tried. Here's how it worked. Or this is something that I really wanted to work, but it just didn't turn out. And then we get to share that too. So we come away with even more ideas at the end of the workshop. So what were some of these things that we were doing to go beyond our postcard and calendar shots? Well, I have 7 of them right here. And I'm just going to roll through them, because these are things that you can do on your own when you're not at a workshop. Hopefully you will come to one of our workshops next year and be able to try them out with other photographers. But in the meantime, let's see what we got right here. All right, here we go. First one. This was very popular. Almost everyone did some form of this. Either custom color profiles, film simulations, and art filters. Now, depending on what camera brand you work with, we have Fuji shooters and we have OM system shooters. Oh, well, I was shooting the Nikon ZF. And so, you know, we had a variety of different camera brands, but every mirrorless camera brand has some form of color profile or film simulation or art filters built into it. And these are so much fun to work with, and especially with the fall colors. The fall colors are fantastic, but after a while, you start to see the kind of the same yellow and blue combination, yellow from the trees and blue from the sky. And you kind of want to do something else with it, something to take it to a little different place. In the Nikon I was using, I have custom color profiles because Nikon has created a hub where you can download custom color profiles created by other photographers in addition to the ones that they have loaded into the camera itself. OM System has done the same thing. They also have a hub where you can go and download custom color profiles for the OM3 and their other cameras. And they also have them built into the camera. And of course, Fuji shooters have those beautiful film simulations already in their camera and ready to use. I found a couple custom profiles that just, oh, I don't know, they just really changed the scene in a direction that was a bit warmer. Because, you know, when you're in high altitude, we were always at 6,000 feet or more, things feel a little cool in terms of the lighting. And so I found some that really warmed up the scenes in a very pleasing way. And I shot a RAW plus JPEG, of course. So the JPEGs had my custom color profile applied, and then the RAWs were the RAWs interpreted by the application that I was using. And then they would be presented to me side by side on the computer. So it was really nice to see, okay, here's sort of the basic shot, the raw file with its beautiful raw processing. And then here is the custom color shot. And I almost always went for the custom color shot. It's nice to have the raws. and you can go back and play with them later on if you want. But I almost always went for the custom color shots. And because the lighting was so good, I mean, I didn't really need the raw files anyway. They didn't have to have any great shadow areas to recover or any blown out highlights or any of that kind of stuff. The JPEGs looked fantastic. So I had a lot of fun with those, and I basically had some sort of custom color profile turned on the whole time. And as I look at my shots in my gallery here, they just added so much more. They kind of put my own stamp on those beautiful natural images. So that was the first one. The second one was slow shutter speeds with ND filters or polarizers, or sometimes both. So we had times when we had water. I mean, we had lakes everywhere. We went to about six lakes during the week. And then we also had streams to play with. And so you had moving water that you could do something with. Now, the thing about the moving water this time of year is that it has reflections in it. It has reflections from the aspens and cottonwoods that are around these lakes and streams and the blue sky itself. So you have reflections in the water, these colors in the water, and why not do something with it? So what some people did, and these shots just turned out beautifully, is that they would slow down their shutter speeds, you know, way down by using ND filters and polarizers, and get that water movement with the colors being reflected from the sky and the trees, and create these beautiful semi-abstract images. Now, you still knew that it was water from a stream or whatever, so it was, you know, not totally abstract, but it was beautiful. It was really great. And so I loved these shots. We had a few of them in the presentation, and they just turned out so well. And such a good reminder that when you have moving water and you have color in the water, especially, that you can do some very beautiful things. And I'm not talking about everything being that super flowy, angelic-like thing, you know, where the shutter speed is like a minute or something like that. I'm talking about just slowing it down a bit so that you have motion. And then, of course, if you have a rock or something and the water is going around it, then that rock is nice and sharp and clean, and then that flowing color around it. So I'm talking about things that were like 5-second exposures or 10-second exposures that were really gorgeous. So that was the second technique that I thought was employed quite well. Technique number three, infrared photography, either monochrome or color. And we had a couple infrared photographers there, and then other people were experimenting with it. They had a filter for their camera and could get some nice IR720. But in certain locations, and especially at Bodie, the ghost town, that's the California State Park, was a gold mining town that has been preserved by the California State Park System. Just an amazing place. The IR from Bodie was gorgeous. Now, last time I was at Bodie, not this time, but last time I was at Bodie, I shot IR exclusively, and I love that photo shoot. But we also had Mono Lake, which is kind of this surreal sort of moonscape kind of thing anyway. And the IR there was also quite impressive. And then they were shooting IR in everywhere else too. There was really no limit, you know, in terms of subject as to what would be an IR shot or not. And both the monochrome, which gave you these very dramatic black and white shots, and again, especially at altitude, with a deep blue sky, that deep blue sky would go very dark in monochrome IR. It was quite gorgeous. And then the color, where you would have false color for an already colorful scene. So all of the IR thought was really a breath of fresh air and quite interesting. And that was the third technique that people were employing there during the workshop. Alongside of it was regular black and white. So you had IR black and white, but we also had black and white that was captured both in camera using custom profiles or applied later in post-production using either Silver Effects Pro or On One or Luminar, you know, one of those applications where you could say, let's go back to Bodhi for a second and really, you know, capture something that felt very period, because this ghost town is period already. They try to arrest the decay of the town so that they can preserve the look of how it was during its heyday. And that kind of subject material takes really well to black and white and sepia photography. And it's fun to shoot in camera with mirrorless cameras using the custom profile, because when you look through the viewfinder, the electronic viewfinder, you're actually seeing the world in black and white. Something that I would have given my eye teeth for back in the film days to be able to see in black and white while I was capturing it. And the black and white just went over really well. Another place that I thought it worked really well was at these glacier lakes. So you would have this blue water, and then you would have these jagged mountains all around it, you know, where the lake was probably carved out via glacier. And then you would have this intense blue sky. And that combination of elements really made for dramatic black and white work. And you could enhance it by using a red filter to deepen the sky even more. It was just really a joy to see some of the black and white work there. And it's kind of fun to feel like you're Ansel Adams, you know, when you look through the viewfinder of your camera and see something that you go, wow, this is what he shot, you know. So the black and white, both in camera and in post-production, was very popular and quite beautiful. Our fifth technique was something that I love and that I'm not very good at yet, but boy, some of our workshop participants were fantastic at it, which is intentional camera movement. Known as ICM, where you're moving the camera while the shutter is open. And they were shooting stands of aspens in particular using this method of moving the camera in a vertical direction from bottom to top with the shutter open, just creating these lovely, almost what I would say impressionistic sort of creations. And they would vary. Like some of the intentional camera movement shots still had a detail from like the aspen trunks and so forth. And then other ones were even softer, you know, more soft, you know, more blurred. And with the palettes of colors that we had to work with, this technique was excellent, was just excellent. And the shots that were in the presentation of people who did intentional camera movement, I loved them all. I thought they were terrific, and what a great place to do it where you have fall foliage and so forth. So that was our fifth technique, and one that I'd like to practice and get better at, because I really enjoyed a lot of those shots. Number six was reflections, and there were all sorts of opportunities for reflections in the streams, as I mentioned before, with the color, in the lakes, where you would have the mountains reflected in the lake or other objects. But then also in the windows, for example, at Bodhi, in that old ghost town, in those old windows, where you would use the reflection of the scene from the ghost town itself, but point your camera at the window instead of directly at the scene and capture it that way. And there was one shot in particular by Jeff where he photographed that old truck that's in Bodhi. Anyone who's been to Bodhi has photographed that truck, but it's a difficult subject to photograph, partly because of the way they paint it. It's this really bright enamel blue that I don't think is really that pretty, to tell you the truth. And he photographed it in a reflection of an old window of a building that was next to the truck, and it just transformed that subject into something very interesting, and it felt like a period piece when you looked at it. It was really good. I enjoyed it a lot, and I thought it was terrific. But there are all sorts of things that you can do with reflections, you know, in windows, water, all that kind of stuff. And I was really glad that folks remembered about that technique, because some of the very impressive shots during the presentation were employing reflections. Very good technique, and one that we forget about. And the last technique, shooting into the sun. And, you know, it's so dramatic when you have these backlit colorful trees, the aspens and so forth, and then maybe you have the sun peeking through the branches, maybe you stop down a bit and get a star effect from the sun, or you're just going with the backlighting of those colorful leaves. But remembering to shoot into the sun instead of having it at your back or at your shoulder is such an excellent technique and really creates drama. And then when you're working on the shots in the computer, if you need to open up the shadows a bit, you can, but you have this wonderful scene that's just illuminated in a way that's so much different than when the sun is to your back. I really enjoyed those shooting into the sun shots. I thought they were very star-like and terrific and dramatic. So again, the seven techniques, custom color profiles and film simulations, slow shutter speeds, infrared photography, black and white photography, intentional camera movement, reflections, and shooting into the sun. These are all things that you can do when you're out on your own or out with your camera buddies or whatever. These are wonderful techniques to go beyond the standard calendar and postcard shots and really get into something that's different than what your comrades may be doing or what people are used to seeing from these locations. And hats off to our workshop group for being so creative during our week in the Eastern Sierra. One final note before I move on to our industry news is that for our Inner Circle members and for our workshop participants who are on Derek's Story Online, I'm going to post a gallery of examples of these techniques on Derek's Story Online. So if you're hanging out there, if you're a member there, keep an eye peeled. I'm going to do it this week. And you'll be able to see some of this terrific work that these folks did. I have a few interesting stories for you from the world of photography. The first one I want to start out with is on Digital Camera World. And I thought this was interesting and kind of keeping with the theme of today's show, which is Rico and Realme are working on a smartphone camera with film-like aesthetic for people tired of perfect photos. And again, this is on Digital Camera World, and I have a link in the show notes. Rico, the brand behind the well-loved compact cameras for street photography like the Rico GR4 and the GR3, is working on a smartphone camera with the China-based brand Realme. Realme and Rico are teaming up to launch a new smartphone on October 14th, which should be today for most of you. Realme will launch a new smartphone in the GT8 Pro series that has a camera powered by the Rico GR series. While the teaser was scarce on details, the company's comments offer a few hints as to what a smartphone camera powered by the same company behind the Rico GR4 and GR3 may look like. One comment from the announcement in particular has me eager to see what exactly is coming. Quote, "This device seamlessly blends nearly 30 years of Rico GR heritage, including its iconic film-like aesthetic and five classic image tones, with Realme's strength in mobile imaging and profound insights into the preferences of current generations, creating unique synergy that advances street photography culture through joint development and co-engineering." The color profiles on the Rico GR3 HDF were one of my favorite features on that camera, and the announcement makes the upcoming camera phone sound like it will be more film-inspired approach rather than focus on computational photography of many flagship smartphones. Quote, "People are getting tired of the same perfect style photos. More and more everyone wants to show their own style instead of copying the same look," Realme's vice president and CMO said. Color profiles aren't the only tease in the partnership announcement. Realtime says that the GT8 Pro will include groundbreaking innovations in optical capabilities, color algorithms, imaging tones, and tailor-made UI design that mimics the feel of a Rico GR camera. So this sounds pretty interesting. I'm going to keep an eye on it. There's more about this in the article. Again, that's on Digital Camera World, link in the show notes. But this could be very interesting smartphone. Yeah, yes, indeed. And by the way, speaking of smartphones, I did have my iPhone 17 Pro with me in the Sierra. And I did shoot with it, of course, always. But I was so excited about the techniques that I was talking about in the first story that I did not shoot with it as much as I thought. However, if it had some of those things built in, like with my Nikon or OM system camera, I may have shot with it a bit more. Who knows? Anyway, this looks like a very interesting camera. I'm going to keep an eye out, see what happens with it. Speaking of the Ricoh GR4, the article on Petapixel says that sales charts show the Ricoh GR4 is picking up where the GR3 left off. I have a link in the show notes to this article. The highly anticipated Ricoh GR4 premium compact camera finally arrived on store shelves in Japan last month, and it made what Japanese retailer Map Camera calls a spectacular debut, landing squarely in first place on the retailer's September sales charts. Top-selling camera lists from Japanese photo retailers provide one of the best metrics for measuring a camera's retail success. While Map Camera's sales data, reported by Digicam Info, offers a relatively small sample size and only includes data from Japanese retail operations, the data typically reflects broader consumer behavior patterns as well as worth looking at when trying to better understand what photographers are most excited about. In September, shutterbugs were enthralled by the Ricoh GR4. It's not surprising that the GR4 is a smash hit, as not only are all versions of the Ricoh GR3 still very popular at various retailers, even many years after their launch, but the GR4 is fantastic. In Petapixel's Ricoh GR4 review, Chris Nichols calls it a successor worth waiting for. The camera earned the Petapixel's Editor Choice Award and comes highly recommended, even with its higher $1,500 price point. Well done, Ricoh, and I'm really happy for all the GR shooters out there who have a new camera to work with some really nice improvements. This little guy, you know, it fits in any pocket, has a lot of creative tools. It's beautifully made, and I'm just excited that compact cameras are once again very hot because they are very nimble, and with today's technology, they are very capable. So congratulations, Ricoh, on another fantastic version of the GR. Kodak launches Kodakolor 100 and 200 to feed the film resurgence. And this is an article that's on The Verge. By the way, I mentioned earlier that last time I went to Bodie, I shot all in IR. This time when I went to Bodie, I loaded up my Nikon FG with a Voigtlander 40mm lens, and I shot a roll of film, a roll of color film, and only color film during my Bodie experience this time. Now, I don't know how the shots turned out yet because I still have to send it off, but I'm really looking forward to that film look combined with that Bodie aesthetic. I have my fingers crossed that I'm really going to enjoy the shots. Film photography, of course, is as popular as ever in the digital age, and Kodak appears to be listening. Let's see what the article says. It's been a while since Kodak launched a new film, and even longer since it actually distributed it its own. But the company caught people by surprise yesterday when it announced two new film products, Kodakolor 100 and Kodakolor 200. Just as important, it announced that it would be distributing them itself rather than going through Kodak Alaris, which has handled distribution since the company split following bankruptcy proceedings in 2012. In an Instagram post, Kodak described Kodakolor as sub-brands of the existing Kodak films, meaning that they're not a completely new film stack. My suspicion is that Kodacolor 100 is based on Pro Image 100 and Kodacolor 200 based on Color Plus 200, judging from the limited sample images I've seen. While new names on existing films might be less exciting than completely new film stock, this is a big deal for photographers who have been facing steadily increasing film prices over the last several years. Increased capacity following upgrades at its Rochester, New York factory and cutting out the middlemen should mean Kodak should be able to get more film into customers' hands faster to better meet demand. More supply should also mean more stable prices. Prices for color film has increased at least 50% since 2020, and for some stocks, it's doubled. Kodacolor 100 and Kodacolor 200 are also relatively inexpensive at around $9 a roll, which should make them attractive to those looking to dabble in film photography for the first time. All right, and that's an article that's on The Verge. More film. I'm very happy about that. The film that I shot Fujicolor 200 in Bodie, vintage 2014, but it's been in my refrigerator. It should have a little shift, but hopefully not too much. Let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. I want to start out with a live view. I haven't talked about our publication on medium.com for a while, but Live View now has over 6,000 followers. It has dozens and dozens and dozens of articles. We've been publishing 2 to 3 articles a week since its inception and built up a nice, just a really nice inventory of articles in the publication. And if you haven't gone over and taken a look, you really should. You really should because, you know, a lot of these writers come from our own audience, our own digital story audience, but then we also have international authors from Australia, from England, from Asia, from India, all over the world who bring their own flavor and brand of photography to the publication. And there is so much to learn there. We do reviews of camera equipment. We talk a lot about technique. We talk a lot about creative techniques. We talk about technology as it relates to imaging. It's good stuff. I mean, it really is good stuff. And if you want to take a look, all you have to do is go to medium.com/live-view. That's medium.com/live-view. I have a link to it in the show notes. You get to read a handful of articles for free. A lot of folks end up signing up for $5 a month, and then you get everything that's available via medium.com. Not just our Live View stuff, but everything that covers practically every topic on the planet. And if you're interested in writing for us, please send me an email, dstory@gmail.com, and I'll get back to you. We are always looking for new contributors to our Live View publication. And I really appreciate the writers that we have. I love our audience, and I just want to keep it going. So that's medium.com/live-view. Stop by and take a look. I want to give a shout out to our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that power our community month in and month out. So much fun hanging out with Inner Circle members in the Eastern Sierra. You know, when you have a stake in something like the Inner Circle members have in our community, when you're a contributor, it feels good. It feels like not only do you belong, but that you're helping, you know, move all of this forward, that you're contributing to this beautiful thing that we all enjoy so much. And you get benefits. You absolutely get benefits. You get discounts. You get insights. Like, for instance, you Inner Circle members are going to get to see the gallery from the Eastern Sierra that I'm going to be posting. If you're interested in joining us and becoming a part of this, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there. You'll then get email from me and we'll get you inside the Inner Circle, hanging out in our online site and also setting you up with the benefits. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this community. And finally, I'd like to thank our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. Boy, do I have some images I want to print from the Eastern Sierra. You know, it's interesting. One of the comments that you get from both photographers, but also from people who just appreciate photography, is when they see an image that they like. Like when I'm showing them, let's say, a dozen shots from the Eastern Sierra, and one really resonates with them, they go, oh, you should print that. And I get that comment all the time, as does other photographers. And that is really such a telling comment. You should print that. In other words, you should make that art even more artful. You should have something that is tangible. You should have something that you can hand to other people or put on the wall or mail in a fine art card. You should print that. That is probably one of the best compliments you can get for one of your photographs. And I just love that saying, and I agree, you should print that. We talked about printers and so forth during the workshop, and I'm sure that a number of prints will be made from the Eastern Sierra, including a couple by myself. If you have a shot that is worthy of being printed, you should print that as well. And the best place to start is by clicking on the Red River paper tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Nose around a bit, get some paper, and start making beautiful artwork that you can share with other people. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for sponsoring this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, be creative, take some pictures. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.